Hello and welcome to the Squawker Talker. My name is Sam Long and today I'm joined by Jake Entwistle, Squawker Assistant Editor. How are you, Jake?
It usually goes to Mo first, so I picked up the coffee to have a sip then and had to swiftly put it back down, but I'm good, yeah, thanks.
And also joined by Squawker's Chief Writer, Mohammed Butt. How are you, Mo?
Yeah, I'm all right. Loving the Nations League.
So let's kick off with England. 2-1 defeat to Spain on Friday night, which goes down as England's first competitive defeat at Wembley since 2007, God, and the first in 11 games there under Gareth Southgate. So what do we think the issues are that need to be addressed? How can the three lines bridge the gap to the better opposition?
Drop Harry Kane.
Straight in with fire. I think, firstly, that's why, you know, UEFA Nations League is bad, because now we've lost that record. 11 years.
Yeah.
If we lost to Spain before, then it wouldn't have been competitive. But that's come in, and I think you could see that it was a more competitive game straight away, which was good. But and taking the lead straight away again, it's England doing those fast starts that we're really good at, and then not being fast for the rest of the game. I think that's the problem, and the big thing in that is just being able to control these games. That's always been England's sort of prerogative, to start really fast and then not really know what to do if you're winning or losing. It just gets to that last half an hour of the game and we look a bit lost. But Gareth Southgate, I think, came out and said that we need to be brave with the principles and the style of play that he's trying to implement.
Yeah.
Talking about how if we went back to the old ways that we'd never become a top team. So he's having a bit of a dig there about where England's been going in the past, and I think it's more again to do with this golden generation concept about how they weren't really a team and they were just put on the pitch and said do well. So I like the fact that Gareth Southgate's actually trying to have a philosophy and instill the philosophy that, again, not winning the UEFA Nations League isn't what he's going to be judged on. Playing against better teams means that there's a better test for this philosophy. Obviously, a lot of people now, the people that during the World Cup are saying, oh, they've only beaten Panama and Tunisia, they've got more of a stance to lean on now, because they say, like, you've played Belgium twice and now played Spain and lost all the games, and obviously Croatia as well. So it's, are we even that good? And I think, yeah, maybe we're not brilliant, but I think that the foundations are being put in place to be brilliant in the future. And there's just a couple of little tweaks. Obviously, Mo going straight in with the Harry Kane fire. There's a couple of little tweaks that might need to be made, but I think the most positive thing is that Gareth Southgate wants to build a style of play and wants to give England an identity which has been lacking for years.
Yeah, I can't speak highly enough of Gareth Southgate after. I mean, obviously, I thought he was great before the World Cup when I saw his squad. After watching England play at the World Cup, I thought, yeah, this guy's really good. Like Jake says, his comments about, no, we're not going to, because I'm sure everyone's like, go 4-4-2. Yeah, and he was just like, no, this is how we're playing. We're going to stick to it. And he's right, because honestly, the biggest thing that makes the greatest teams as great as they are is mental strength. They don't get worried about what they're doing. The great Barcelona side and Pep Guardiola, this great Real Madrid team, when they're facing adversity, they keep their cool. That's what lets them keep winning these games, winning and winning and winning. It's because when it all starts going wrong, and the great Spain side, speaking of international football, when it all starts going wrong, they keep their head. And you can always see it, like, there are always teams that come out, like, for example, against Spain, they would come out and press Spain, and Spain would be like, ooh, and then Spain would string, like, 10, 15 passes together, and suddenly the other team's like, uh-oh, and they panic, and they'd stop doing what they were doing, and Spain would then play their game. And that's the level England need to get to, you know, where okay, the fast start is now becoming something legendary, right? Now you need to figure out how to then pair that with a slow middle. I mean, we'll get onto the midfield later, so I'm not going to touch on that right now. But I said drop Harry Kane, and that's not like 100% serious, but it's not a joke either. I think he very clearly is nowhere near. I mean, I don't know what happened in the middle of the Colombia game, whether he got injured or something. They're all saying he's fit. They're saying he's not got an injury, but he has not looked right since the middle of that Colombia game, both for club and country. Like we said in a previous, I think it was last week's pod, Jake was saying his shot numbers are down. His shot, you know, just the fact that his shot numbers are down, and goals are down, whatever, but shot numbers are down. Because remember, last season in August, he had like, I don't know how many shots before scoring a goal, and it, like, he ruined his shot conversion for the entire season. He had that many shots. but he hasn't had that many shots, hasn't attempted at goal this season. He's not running in the same way that he used to this season. Now, again, maybe it's just a fitness thing and he'll work his way back. Maybe he's exhausted. I don't know what it is. But you look at the way England have played since the Colombia game, when England were actually playing well, and it's basically with one striker. You know, it's the striker is either in Raheem Sterling or Marcus Rashford. Kane just is dropping into attacking midfield zones. He's linking play, which is absurd because it's so funny because he's wearing the 9 for England. He wears 10 for Spurs. If he was doing that for England, you'd think, yeah, that makes sort of sense visually. I can understand it. But he's wearing the 9. He's dropping deeper. And it's just, it's not what England need from him. England need him to be up and in attack, being a link man with whoever, either Sterling or Kane, and then making the, and Rashford, sorry, they're making the kind of runs that he makes for Spurs, threatening goal. He did it once, I think, against Spain, and he was off, he missed the shot and he was offside, but it was, just the fact that he missed the shot, I know he was offside, but he should be, he would have buried that. And I don't know what it is, whether he needs like a proper, like 1 month, just a holiday, just to be left alone and just to recuperate, or maybe he needs surgery or something on injury. I don't know what it is, but there's something wrong with him that started the middle of that Colombia game. And I think until England figure out what that is, I think, yeah, dropping him might, resting him might work. But this is why you can't drop him. He's captain. This is why I didn't like him being captain. See, when your star striker is your captain, you've got your star striker. It's hard enough to drop your star striker. Hard enough to drop your captain. If they're both the same dude, it's basically impossible.
I think he's almost become a victim of how good he's become. Because this thing about dropping off is like, for England's goal, what he did to set up Luke Shaw on that run was brilliant. That's like what you want from your striker. He's dropped deep, he's turned a defender, sprayed it out wide, and England have scored. Obviously, he's not got then the pace to catch back up with it, but that's why you play two strikers, because it was Rashford that was there to score it. So Harry Kane, I think, when he first started, he was literally scoring goals. That's what he did. He just scored goals. And that's why the one season wonder sort of tag got labelled on him, because it was like, all you're doing is scoring. You're not showing us that you're a good player. But then every year he added something new to his game. And now he's become one of the most complete forwards in Europe. And that might be affect him in negatively, because it's like, oh wait, you can do this, so what if we try and get you to do this more? Oh wait, you can do this. And now you're asking Harry Kane to do every single thing in the final third, and he's lost the essence of what he was really good at. And when you're playing up front on your own, yes, you want someone to do everything. So if we were playing two people behind Harry Kane, then maybe you'd say, yeah, you drop deep, because then you've got two people running off you, like he has for Spurs. Dele Alli just running beyond him all the time. Dele Alli gets in more forward positions than Harry Kane at the start of this season. A lot of the goals, he arrives back post, Eriksen clips it in. It's not Harry Kane heading it in, it's Alli, because Kane's dropped deep and linked that and started all that move. So now we're starting to see that with England, but because he has more people doing that for Spurs, it's not as obvious. But
also, he has Christian Eriksen for Spurs, which is the big thing.
And that's the thing. But so in this 3-5-2, which I like, it's starting to be like, you need to nail down Kane's role, because he's trying to do everything. And because he is now good at everything, he can dribble when he wants to. Spurs did an incredible compilation of his like 90-yard crossfield balls and just switching play. And they were all superb. It's not the fact that he's a brilliant player, but now I think because he's become so good at everything, he's learnt a new skill every year. Now he's almost got too many to pick from. If you look at someone like Cristiano Ronaldo can do everything still, maybe not to the same extent, but he's just said, I'm just going to use my movement, be in the box. He still takes a lot of shots, but he refined his play, and that's why he's had this longevity. Kane at the moment is at the peak of his powers. It's like, wow, I can do all of these things. Why don't I try and do them all? And it's actually not having a positive effect, which obviously is odd.
Yeah, it's the classic thing, isn't it? I disagree. I think Kane's going to be at the peak of his powers around 30. I think what's going to happen then is he's going to have so much experience and so much awareness that he's going to be, as you remember Teddy Sheringham, our listeners remember, that he was so slow sprinting, but he could beat guys anyway, because the first 5 yards were in his, he knew where he was moving. His movement was off the charts intelligent. Zlatan was kind of the same thing. Zlatan's not very fit, fast, but I think once Kane hits about 30, because also, like you said, he's gained all of these superpowers, and it's like, oh, which one should I use now? He doesn't really know how to use it. Once he gets to be like 30, he's going to understand, okay, I'll use this now. His intelligence, his experience is going to become more. I'm not saying Kane is finished. Kane is fantastic. Kane is an absolutely stone cold world class footballer. He's just not playing tactically. I don't know if it's a tactical thing or if it's a fitness thing or something, but he doesn't look at his best right now. I think until you figure out what is wrong with him, whether it's a tactical, whether it's emotional, whatever it is, I think sit him down and get a striker alongside Rashford who can complement him with that. I mean, because Kane can do a little bit of it, but someone who's a bit more mobile, a bit more dynamic. I mean, I would love to have seen Sterling and Rashford play up front together. I think that would be a really interesting duo. With the way that Sterling plays for England, I think a lot of, I think Rashford would actually complement him more than Kane, because then there's a bit more movement and mobility, and they can both sort of link up and play with each other. Whereas when it's him and Kane, he's often the one making runs beyond Kane, and his finishing still isn't quite up to that. But I mean, look, how does England get better? It's there's two things. One is midfield, which is the big thing. We'll talk about that in a second. But the other thing is just defining when you have to define your best player's role. He's England's best player. You have to define his role, and then obviously I do think rest him as well. It's like, look up Messi for Argentina, right? Best player in the world looks lost because Argentina have him doing about six different things at once because they haven't defined his role. And the best coaches they've got the best out of him are the ones that have defined his role for Argentina. So we're talking, God, I can't remember who the coach was in 2014, but basically Sabella, you know, that actually limit him in a way to say, okay, we know you can do everything, but just try and do it a bit further forward, you know. And that's what England need to do with Kane, just figure out his role. And keep pushing Kieran Trippier, keep giving him all the confidence in the world, because it's ridiculous to see how fast he's actually developing. Like, he was great last season, but since going to the World Cup, he's getting better every week. It seems like he's playing that he's passed the Kane. Kane was offside, but he's passed the Kane. That beautiful, like, chipped diagonal pass. It's wonderful. Trippier is, he's a real special talent. Obviously, Luke Shaw too as well. But I think Trippier is, he's hitting the peak of his career now. He's what, 25, 26, something like that.
He's older than that, I think. He's at Burnley for a while.
He's properly coming into the peak of his powers now. He's going to be a really, really important player for England.
So moving away from up front to the midfield.
Yeah.
What do we think England's best midfield looks like? does it have Jordan Henderson in it?
No.
It's sort of quite... I think people, when you say that he's not playing well, they take it like really personally as an attack on him. But again, I think it's this system, in the sense that when he plays for Liverpool, he can afford to play that role because he has two really dynamic people either side of him.
Mm.
And not just dynamic, but dynamic in the defensive sense as well. The system that Gareth Southgate is persevering with, the 3-5-2, which I think suits England because it lets you play three incredible centre-backs at once,
yeah.
And Kyle Walker wasn't even in the team. So I think that's why we should do it, because the strength is there. Gomez has been incredible this season. Maguire is one of the most unique centre-backs in the Premier League, and John Stones will become great. I know he's might be taking longer than usual, but we don't have anyone else like him. So they all complement each other perfectly. The thing is then is that you want to play Dele Alli and Jesse Lingard because they're both brilliant, but they're very similar in the sense that they thrive moving off the ball, and they're very attack minded. So that exposes Henderson to deal with a lot of pressure himself.
Yeah.
And when we've come up against the good teams, he doesn't look like he's been able to deal with it. And again, that's not... Everyone's allowed a weakness. This isn't an attack on Jordan Henderson's ability as a footballer, but he would maybe prefer, in this sort of system, someone alongside him, or he needs the cover in front of him, people that can work backwards and forwards. In the same way that Granit Xhaka's always exposed at Arsenal because he's immobile and he's not actually that great at defending. When Jordan Henderson plays, he has got strengths, and England sometimes miss Jordan Henderson's strengths, but at this moment in time, against teams like Spain, him in that role, his passing accuracy was one of the lowest and of the outfield players. And people and pundits, especially from the olden days, get very annoyed about this. Oh, 90% pass accuracy doesn't mean anything. Try and find a forward pass. You don't always want to find a forward pass. England find their forward passes in the first 20 minutes and take a 1-0 lead. You don't need to then just keep playing high risk.
Keep looking for forward passes.
Yeah, high risk. Obviously, you still want to implement and impose some sort of attacking threat. But if you look at the people that play with Henderson at Liverpool, Wijnaldum, I don't think he's ever dipped below 98% pass accuracy. And he doesn't do anything special, but he behaves like that.
James Milner.
And James Milner does it as well. And England don't have that because Dele Alli and Jesse Lingard are hyper-intelligent off the ball creative forces that want to play through balls and intricate passes with their forwards. Henderson wants to do that as well because what he's brilliant at is sort of receiving the ball facing sort of towards the touchline and clipping it over to one of the faster wingers.
He had a great cross yesterday, actually, against, he stepped forward into attack. It was a great cross. I think it was to Kane. It was a really, really nice cross. And honestly, if you play Henderson in this system, I would put him in one of the midfield, in one of the two ahead of him. I wouldn't, yeah, the base in midfield, it just plays to all his weaknesses. He's not a number six. He never has been a number six. And I think putting him there, obviously, has its strengths because obviously his passing range is fantastic. He can really get the ball forward in a hurry to your wide area, to your wingers. If, you know, for Klopp, it made sense to play him there because it fit what they were trying to do with Mohamed Salah, with Sadio Mane. But even Jurgen Klopp now is starting to realise there's limits to how far you can go with Jordan Henderson at the base of your midfield, because ultimately against elite teams that can have players who can play between the lines, he's going to lose them because he's not a defensive midfielder. And I think England have made great use of Henderson to sort of unleash this forward team, but he's now become the kind of player where you only play him at the base of midfield against teams you're going to beat.
Yeah.
You know, I said this during the World Cup, I thought, well, surely Dier will come in against stronger teams. But Dier looked equally lost in the system.
When Dier came in, he was bad. That was worrying.
I think maybe it's because the system ahead of him is so dynamic. Like, Dier at Spurs is always used to playing with someone next to him, and there's a bit of solidity there, whereas England is just... So, I mean, to me, you ask me, what does England's best midfield three look like? I think it's one of Lingard or Dele Alli. I love both of them. I think they're both magnificent. But for the system, and this is what Southgate is about, it's the system, you've got to pick one. You can't have both, I think, because neither of them is truly comfortable being an on-the-ball playmaker. Dele does it, but kind of slowly. Lingard tries a lot, does it much quicker, but it's never as accurate. And both of them are exceptional off the ball. And I think if you only have one of them, they can then do what they do more. Do you know what I mean? Like, you get more out of Dele Alli if there's a proper playmaker. This is what I'm saying. This is what Jake was alluding to earlier about Dele for Spurs. Because there's Eriksen. Eriksen's on the ball. He's a playmaker. So Dele's just off the ball, running beyond Kane. And then maybe you fix Kane's problems. So one of those two, I don't know who you pick. You can honestly flip a coin and pick one. They're both as good as each other. I think Lingard perhaps fits the intensity of the system a bit more. But Dele knows all the Spurs players so well, it's hard to argue against that. Honestly, either way, I think you got to put Harry Winks or Nathaniel, not now, but yeah, this is what you need to build to, is Harry Winks or Nathaniel Chalobah at the base of midfield, because they are players who can pass it forward, yes, bring it forward, carry it, do all that stuff, but they can defend, they know how to play, that is their position. Harry Winks was excellent at the base of midfield against Real Madrid for Spurs in the Champions League. Fantastic. He's the player you want to put there. Chalobah also, we've not seen it as much at the top level, but we've seen the potential this guy has is through the roof. So, and I mean, hopefully we'll see it this season playing at the base next to Doucouré for Watford. I think he'll be the defensive anchor of that team, well, positionally anyway. And I think if he can have a good season, I think he'll be a genuine option going forward, because he is really, really special.
And Southgate loves
him
and Loftus-Cheek, because they were his Loftus-Cheek and Lewis Baker were Southgate's under-21 generals, so I think he wants to get them in as soon as possible.
Yeah, and Loftus-Cheek is the third one for me. He's the third midfielder, because he's the guy that can be on the ball, carry it forward, look to play passes. Actually, and then when he has to, slot, turn around, pass it back to someone else. Yeah, but you watch Loftus-Cheek, he's never in a hurry when you watch Loftus-Cheek. He's never like, I've got to do something now. I mean, he'll do it if it's there to be done. Yeah, he's a very, very smart player. Yeah, he'll dribble when he's there to be dribbled, but he's not... For a guy who is so very skilled, it's never when he came on for England against Tunisia in the World Cup, he was like flying at them every time he got the ball, run, because that's what England needed a goal. When he played against Panama, it wasn't like that. It was a bit more restrained every time. And you know, he plays according to the situation of the game, as far as I've seen anyway. And I think he's a very intelligent player. Obviously, as Jake says, Southgate loves him. Southgate trusts him immensely. So I think you put him... I mean, you could maybe put Oxlade-Chamberlain in when he returns from injury.
But that injury looks...
But, I mean, yeah, exactly. Will he be the same? Phil Foden could be a very good shot once he develops a bit more. Obviously, he's not ready yet. But for the future, maybe Mason Mount, perhaps. Maybe he's a bit too adventurous. But, you know, that... Basically, you want someone who can play. And there's not many... England don't produce many players like this. Because it's the kind of... You know, Spain have like 15 of them, you know, and England have maybe one Loftus-Cheek. So, but this is the kind of thing England will produce more of in the future. Obviously, Foden is a great example. And I think that's the third one. So you have you have Winks or Chalobah at the base. You have Lingard or Dele in the attacking roaming role. And then you have Loftus-Cheek or Phil Foden or something to be the playmaker. I think that gives you a nice balance.
I think as much as I'm a fan of Ruben Loftus-Cheek, I think that role, like, we identified that what England basically need to find is a Christian Eriksen. And I think the closest thing that England have to a fit player that is Christian Eriksen at the moment is probably James Maddison at Leicester.
Oh, actually, yeah, that's
He's come in and straight from Norwich gone in the Premier League. Leicester have looked good. Their points belie how impressive they've looked on the ball. And they're playing, obviously, a different system, a 4-2-3-1, but he's playing as 10. He is asking for the ball all the time, constantly turning, constantly looking to feed his wingers. And he looks so comfortable. Obviously in the under 21 setup at the moment, and I think there are calls for him to be in this squad by quite a lot of people.
Or Dele Alli pulled out this morning, so
that would be a really good opportunity. You get to then you don't have to choose between Dele and Jesse Lingard for that role that Mo was talking about, and then you can try this playmaker. And again, maybe Henderson is a more reserved version of that, and you play him there, and you put someone else behind him to just complete 50 passes out of 52 attempted. That's what England need. Someone that can control a game. Harry Winks did it twice against Real Madrid. So I think when he's fit and Chalobah's fit, that's the problem. We're waiting on those. And that's why Southgate hasn't found a player, because we're waiting on fitness issues. But yeah, I think the closest player England have to a sort of Christian Eriksen-esque playmaking style is James Maddison.
God, yeah, that is a really good shout, actually.
Because Mason Mount could be there, but he's 2 years behind and obviously playing in the Championship at the moment, so Southgate might be waiting for him to build up a bit more. But then you've got a production line. And then another person that could perhaps do it is Ross Barkley, who's a forgotten guy.
Oh my God, Ross Barkley.
I think with all these players, though, it's difficult to make a case. As long as, if Henderson's playing week in, week out for Liverpool and they're sort of challenging, he's playing in the Champions League.
Yeah.
Like Winks, Chalobah, Loftus-Cheek, they're sort of bit part players at their clubs until they play regularly, then it is going to be difficult for Southgate to leave Henderson out.
And that's what Southgate said himself. He said it's going to be difficult for young players to get in now because the Premier League don't do enough to give them the platform to shine. I think he's very aware of who he wants to pick, but as you said, Loftus-Cheek hasn't had a minute since being back at Chelsea. So he can't play him because there's not the match fitness there. If Henderson is playing, as you said, 90 minutes every week, then you know he's going to be up to the task when he plays. And even if you're getting 60 minutes a game, that's still more than none. Like, you want someone that's playing. So that's the problem. And Southgate addressed it and was quite firm in addressing it as well. He's like, I can't just call up young players if they're not playing. At least with the likes of Danny Welbeck, who isn't getting minutes, he's got 10,000 minutes under his belt. You know that he'll be able to step in and be match fit. Whereas these 22-year-olds that we all love and want to see, Southgate does have a point. But that's why I think James Maddison is a good
player. I'm now obsessed with James Maddison playing for England now. You've put that idea in my head, and it's absolutely brilliant. I can't believe I forgot about him. Yeah, that's. Yeah, scratch my idea. Maddison in the third role. I think that's actually very good. No, I'm convinced now. I'm 100% convinced. I'm on board. The hype train is going.
So moving away from England over to Spain.
Yeah.
Obviously, I had a bit of a mare in Russia.
That's putting it kindly.
How do we think they're going to progress under Luis Enrique?
I think they're doing all right. I think they're... it's one game. He's been training with them for a week, so, you know, and it's very early on. But you can already see sort of the signs of luchismo, if you want to call it that. You know, they look fitter and sharper than usual, but mostly it's a mental toughness. The thing with Luis Enrique is, technically, he's pretty simple. It's 4-3-3 when you have the ball, 4-4-2 when you don't. So one of the wide players tracks back. In this case, for Barcelona, it was Neymar. In this case, for Spain, it was kind of Isco, but also kind of Rodrigo. It kind of varied, but mostly it was Isco. And, you know, so, but tactically, it wasn't like, oh my God, really, this is genius. But it's mentally where they really shone, because, you know, they went 1-0 down. And England always slow down and everything, but the way they responded was instant. They got equalised so quickly, and it was like, okay, we're no messing, we're going back up the other end. And then they turned the game around before half time. You know, it was very, very assured. And the second half, what they did was, because this is the thing, Spain have been going easy, slowly ebbing away from the golden era of defend with possession thing, right? Not like necessarily through choice, but just because Xavi isn't there anymore, so it's like harder to do, and everyone's just sort of been slowly becoming more and more vertical. Lopetegui, even his team was more vertical, you know, when they had, and it, so it's harder for them sometimes to defend lead Spain, because they're not actually, like, in terms of actual just defending, it's not really their forte. But under Luis Enrique now, you're seeing a team that is comfortable saying, yeah, go on, you have the ball and you can attack us and we will actually defend. Now, I don't think there's still issues to solve. I don't think Nacho is the answer next to Sergio Ramos. I mean, you know, they need to put someone else in there, find someone else in there. Marcos Alonso had a decent game, didn't really do that much, but I mean, you know, he's not going to pick Jordi Alba, so that's fine. But yeah, Saul is huge. The midfield balance was very interesting because obviously we're talking about England not having a balanced midfield. Spain, you know, it's been, do we just play all the playmakers? Do we not? Do we play Koke? How do we work it out? Luis Enrique, no messing around. First game, Busquets holding midfield. Thiago is a playmaker. Saul, off the ball, energy, presence, dynamism, box to box. And it works. It's absolutely perfect because Thiago is great. And in a 4-3-3, rather than playing next to Busquets or in Busquets as well, he's more natural. Busquets, obviously, best midfielder in the world or best defensive midfielder in the world. And Saul is the revelation because he can do everything.
You look very good. Yeah.
Literally everything at an absurdly high level. Like, I mean, you saw his goal. That's not an easy finish. You know, they kicked up and he had to get it down and get it in near post. What is his weak foot? That's the thing. He's so...
it's definitely his right, considering the goals that he scored with his left.
To be fair, to be fair. You know, it's... He can score with his left, his right, his head. He can pass, he can dribble, he can tackle. He's a true all-around midfielder. And honestly, it's kind of weird that it's taken Luis Enrique to finally put this guy in starting for Spain. You know, he's also hard as nails, man. You read what the liver issue he plays through, basically his internal bleeding and what he has to play through, the pain he has to play through every day. It, you know, he's a remarkable footballer. He's like 23 as well. He's not even old. He's so young. So I think Spain looked good. I mean, I think with Saul, they've got their new superstar. You know, up front, once they put Costa in there instead of Aspas,
a shame that Costa didn't play.
Yeah. It is. They'll be very good on. They're going forward. They're going to be quite a meaty side, I think.
I think they're the sort of opposite, and they've got their midfield down. They've always had great midfielders, as Mo said. The balance is pretty much almost perfect, depending on their style. Now they've got this more dynamic Saul next to Thiago. Is one of the most beautiful players to watch play football. Sometimes he looks like he's taking it too easy. I think that's why he gets criticised, but
yeah,
he's so good on the ball. So that midfield is pretty much set. But then, as Mo said, their defence, where you think England's defence is pretty much nailed down. As we said, Kyle Walker didn't play. You could make arguments that he should play instead of Trippier for some games, just for a more sort of vertical dynamic threat rather than just a dead ball crossing delivery. But the England's three centre-backs are sorted. Spain are looking for their Sergio Ramos partner, and then their forward line is always a bit odd considering the players that they used to have and used to associate with it. Sometimes on paper it doesn't look as good, but Rodrigo turned up and looked great. So they have a good side, and in the opposite to England, their midfield just looks like one of the best in the world. Saul, as Mo said, whether you can say master of all now is another thing, but you expect pretty much in 2 or 3 years he will be the master of everything. Because he can do it all.
Yeah. The one thing is, what Jake brought up there about Rodrigo, this forward line not having the big names. But what it's interesting about Rodrigo, I mean, obviously he's 27, so he's not a kid, although he looks like he's about 20. He understands how to play his role. So does Iago Aspas. They don't try and do too much with the ball. When they get it, they keep it very simple. They beat their man, they cross it, you know, as Rodrigo did for the equaliser. And they work so hard. And that's the thing, Luis Enrique is obsessed with hard work and physical fitness, which is why I think he'll be a very good international manager, because so much of international management comes down to players being in shape and working their socks off. So I think once you can add Costa in instead of maybe Aspas, right, and then you have Isco is your hocus pocus. He's the one player you give a little bit of leeway to run free and stuff, and to not maybe work as hard, but he's there. Then you have Rodrigo as your direct running, your pace. And then you have Costa as just your big bully of a forward. You know, that's a very, very good front line if you can get Isco flowing. It's funny, actually. Isco, I thought, would be the future of the Spain team. But now with Luis Enrique in there and with Lopetegui not really finding a space, like sort of almost going... I mean, Isco is his golden child, but he's somehow almost gone away from Isco from Madrid. Like, it's Asensio, the rise of Asensio and the fitness of Gareth Bale. have sort of put Isco on the bench, because I mean he's not going to play in midfield, is he really? So it's be interesting to see what happens to Isco this season, because for a while there Gareth Bale being so out of favour was like giving him a free ride into the team. Now Bale's back in the, you know, in favour, and Benzema's not shifting anywhere. Let's see how much Isco plays, but Isco obviously potentially is a world beater. So Spain look good. Spain look very good.
So next up, we've got another one of the home nations, Wales. They thumped Ireland before losing to Denmark, the actual Denmark as opposed to the futsal players.
Futsal legends.
So how good do we think they can be under Ryan Giggs?
Well, I mean, who knows?
They've got Gareth Bale.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's it, isn't it? I mean, it's, you know, it was funny, actually, after the 4-0, I was like, oh, maybe United should have given it Giggsy, you know. But obviously, it was one game, and the game against Denmark showed that there's still a ways to go. You know, they're all right. They're a working progress. It's really hard to judge Ryan Giggs as a coach because it's such a small sample, so we don't really know what he's planning to do. But the fact that he's playing young players, the fact that he's given Ethan Ampadu, like, just stuck him right in the team. It's like, yeah, you can only admire that. And, you know, unleashing Gareth Bale in attack is always good. Just don't let him dribble in the middle of the pitch. Like the second goal, the penalty against Denmark started because he tried to do Iniesta's little La Croqueta in the middle of the pitch and just completely got it wrong. Like the ball barely left his foot. It's like, Gareth, that's not what you do. You're not a finesse guy. Just blitz these guys with power and pace, please. You know, he tried that, lost the ball, went up the other end, and then very harsh handball to give it against Ampadu. I think Wales are pretty...
If you watch some of the patterns of play they were developing against Ireland and even against Denmark, they obviously didn't have as much of a good time against... And that Denmark hadn't played three games earlier as well. So there's that...
Yeah.
Wales had to play, played really well, travel and do it. So again, this thing about international fitness and the tight schedule, they had the rest because of the futsal players stepping in and they were fully fit. Christian Eriksen, who we mentioned earlier, was again showed why he's one of the best playmakers in the Premier League. But Wales, there's clear patterns. Again, like we were saying with Gareth Southgate's philosophy, one of their first goal against Republic of Ireland, I think it was the first one, so many passes involved. There was one little thing, I don't think it's a full sequence, because there was one little classic Aaron Ramsey anti-skill where he sort of dribbled into someone, fell over, tackled them while he'd fallen over and then got back up and had the ball.
Anti-skill, so I love that. That's great.
So that worked, but it was played out from the back. They've got a number of young players. Ampadu, obviously, who's known playing at Chelsea youth teams as a centre-back, was used as a holding midfielder, was playing some incredible long-range passing. His assist for Aaron Ramsey was a defence-splitting pass from the middle of midfield. So this is an 18-year-old who became the first 2000-born player to get an assist for Wales, threading balls with complete confidence. And
the Welsh Frankie de Jong.
Yeah, and Sarri must be looking at that and thinking, well, we've got a player here. I need to find a way... Maybe not now, but you need to make sure he's integrated as soon as possible, because he looks like he could play as a Europa League Jorginho, or he could play as one of the ball-playing centre-backs, because he's got that confidence on the ball.
I would say now, to be honest, I mean, I know you're saying don't rush it, but I mean, he looks physically ready to compete. I mean, the way he manhandled Julian Walters during that game was amazing. Like, I mean, Julian Walters is a renowned... Jonathan Walters is a renowned bulldog, you know, just an absolute brute, and he just, like, shoved him to the ground, him aside. He's physically capable, and I think when a young player is physically capable, I think you shouldn't be shy about putting him in there.
Not at all, but I'm just saying in terms of Sarri's worked with that fourth... Again, as he... Play him every minute of the Europa League campaign. He's good enough, and he can compete.
Yeah, I would agree.
But I'm saying just all of a sudden... Binning off Rudiger and David Luiz, who are your favoured. But that's not going to happen, is it? We're not going to expect that. But yeah, Ampadu and Christensen as a ball-playing centre-back duo is very, very exciting. And Sarri, I think not having Champions League first season gives him a chance to help teams like Wales. And I hope that he plays them, because one, he needs to rest these players anyway. And two, as I said, Ampadu and Christensen as a centre-back partnership is great. And
it's crazy to think that Christensen
isn't
going to play after he had such a good season.
Yeah.
Well, that's the stylistic thing, isn't it? But that's why I think, like Jake says, him and Ampadu could be really good, because he'll just be the solid guy for him, and Ampadu will be do all the ball playing, stride out of defence like Beckenbauer, and, you know, Christensen just holds things down. I really hope, because Arsene Wenger didn't do it last season, and it really annoyed me, but I really hope that Chelsea used the Europa League just to play their young players, because there are so many good young players. Like, and regularly, I mean, you know, Wenger did it a little bit, gave Nelson games here and there at wing back. And, you know, occasionally brought on Joe Willock and stuff like that. But I would love to see Sarri just go, all right, you know what? I'm resting on my first teamers in the Europa League. Kids, come here. Because the thing is, with system play, and actually to bring back Arsene Wenger, this is what Arsene Wenger discovered in the League Cup years ago, like decades ago. When you have a really set and organised system of play, even young players, if they're talented, can outshine experienced pros. Like Arsenal's League Cup campaigns were always brilliant, you know, with all these young players. That's why all the hype came from, was because Arsene Wenger's system of play was so ingrained in them. They knew how to play, and they knew how to play with each other, and more so than these disparate other League Cup teams. So I would love to see Sally do something similar, because I think the potential is there, and I think Chelsea Youth Academy is so good as well. I think they could put out a really interesting team, a really fun attacking team, like with Callum Hudson-Odoi, Ruben Loftus-Cheek, Ethan Ampadu, Christensen. I'm sure there's more, I can't even think. And you know, it would just be really good fun. I hope he does that.
Mm. It's, as we said though, that helps people like Wales. Obviously, yeah. They've got a lot of Harry Wilson from a Liverpool academy. He's on loan at Derby. Very, he's their youngest ever scorer. Ben Woodburn's from Liverpool. He's at Sheffield United on loan. Chris Meppham is one of the people are really excited about him as a centre back. He was released from Chelsea, I think, really young age. But Wales are building this pedigree of players and this pool of talent that is sort of much younger than England. Like, people are getting excited about England's generation. Wales have a genuinely good six or seven players that are in the team now. And this is because they didn't have the base before. All these players are senior. They had about three teenagers in the starting lineup.
Yeah.
Whereas England still have a decent team, so they're not getting straight in. Ryan Giggs has got free rein to be like, well, we weren't good before, so you might as well start getting these players playing together. And they could be not serious contenders, but if you build that level of, if you keep Aaron Ramsey, Jarlin and Gareth Bale in the team as your three senior members of the squad, Gareth Bale is going to be good for years if he stays fit. Aaron Ramsey, again, should be hitting his peak, injury-free. Joe Allen, again, was playing some incredible passes in that game. It was his assist for the first goal at the end of that move that was incredible. So you've got three experienced good players there, and then Wayne Hennessy in goal was making some good saves against Denmark. So they've got a little base there, a little spine. And then you've got Chris Meppham, Ethan Ampadu, and I haven't even mentioned David Brooks as well, who from Bournemouth, obviously, he was actually the best player at the Toulon tournament for England. And then because Wales were like, this guy is good, we're going to get him in the season team, and now he's obviously played a competitive game, so they've got him locked down. And yeah, as we said, he's been playing for Bournemouth 60 minutes at a time, but he's going to be playing more. So Wales have this clear spine of talent that they can develop, and what's good for Wales is that they're better than what they had already. So they've got this talent of 21 and under running through their team, with Gareth Bale playing up front scoring goals and Aaron Ramsey just roaming everywhere wreaking havoc. So on paper, they've got an exciting time, not just an exciting team, not just for now, but even more so in the future.
Perhaps on the flip side of that, are Belgium, whose golden generation looked like they're sort of coming to an end. Do we think that Euro 2020 is going to be their final chance?
They're still scarred by Robson Kanu, aren't they? As well,
yeah, it absolutely is, though. You look at, it'd be nice to think they'd have another World Cup in them, but you look at their best players, look at the ages, right? Hazard will be 31 in 2022. That's not like the end of his career, but for a fast dribbler, he's clearly going to be coming on the downslope. Vertonghen going to be 35. Alderweireld will be 33. De Bruyne 31. Although De Bruyne is a playmaker, so maybe that's not the end of the world. But Batshuayi will be 28, though. But Fellaini's 34. Witzel's 33. But the two that are really going to be and Courtois going to be 30, but he's a goalie, so that's fine. Mm. But Batshuayi is going to be 28. Lukaku's going to be 29. But Lukaku has now said that maybe he'll retire after Euro 2020, which is weird because he'd be 27. But I mean, if that's how he feels, that's how he feels. I mean, that would be a downgrade for Belgium, because Batshuayi isn't as good as Lukaku, but it's not a massive one. But yeah, you look at the key ages, basically all of them will be over 30. And, for De Bruyne, that's not the end of the world because he's a central midfielder or whatever. It's clearly they're not going to be the same team. World Cup, maybe you could argue, maybe came a bit too soon for them because they only had one tournament together with Martinez. It was their first one. The Euros is going to be perfect for them because they're all going to be 30, either just turned 30, or about to turn 30. They're going to be in that zone. That really is going to be like, okay, we've been there, we've seen it all. Eden Hazard's going to have had 2 years of coaching with Mauricio Sarri, which means, if he absorbs the positional knowledge that Sadi will try and teach him, I mean, yeah, you know, and then Lukaku's gonna be at Man United for 4 years, I think. He's gonna, or 3 years, sorry. He's gonna be in great shape, great rhythm. Alderweireld and Vertonghen will be basically at their peak. They've been playing together for I don't know how long, and they'll be just entering their 30s, which for defenders is usually when they're at their best. The only player who might drop out from the current side is Kompany, maybe, because he'll be a bit, he'll be like 35, I think, then. But their side is set up. I don't see any talent, young talent coming through that's going to replace these names. You know, so it's sort of like, this is the side. This is the time. This side has to get it done. I think 2020 is going to be the perfect time for them to do it. So they had to start building for that. And I think that's why they're locking down Roberto Martinez. You know, there was that rumour that Man United were looking at. I think they're going to be like, no, go away, leave him alone. Because they have a genuine chance. They have a genuine chance to win 2020 with their squad.
So the UEFA Nations League has been a bit of a divisive topic. We weren't sure if fans were going to care about it, if the players were going to sort of care about it. But what have you made of it so far?
I've loved it. I think the games have gone up that level because of it. And as we were saying earlier, you mentioned about Dele Alli being withdrawn from the squad. That's happened after the competitive fixture. And although Pep Guardiola did his classic, oh, everyone's injured, get them out of the squad, which Pochettino needs to learn about, I think. Everyone's been in the squad and now everyone's dropping like flies when there's a friendly around. So I think the players have clearly said, I want to play in these games because they're competitive. They're against teams that we should be testing ourselves against. It must be hard to motivate yourself for a San Marino friendly because there's no benefit of playing that to anyone, not even San Marino, not England.
Even a San Marino qualifier, I would say, the same. Even a San Marino qualifier,
yeah, even
it's
that.
So routine.
But so now actually pitting someone against people that are either at your level or better or slightly worse, it is a good test. And I think we've seen that in a lot of the games. There's been some really interesting developments in the squads as well. People aren't just, as we said, it's quite nice to see youngsters called up, but there's that perfect balance. You're seeing those coaches identify who are the key talents because they're getting these competitive squads rather than just making a host of changes at half time. And I think because the coverage has been quite good, I think people are very keen to make people like the UEFA Nations League. So you see a lot more of it rather than friendlies. Oh, like someone's won 8-0. I didn't know about that. Yeah. People are making supporters very aware of what's happening in it. So in terms of exposure and having football on that's not club football, I think it's been very good. And there have been some exciting games already, including England's against Spain. So I'm all for it, really.
Yeah, I mean, I said it right at the start of the pod. I concur and wholeheartedly. I think it's, you know, the worst thing about international breaks was the friendlies. Nothing meant anything. Even the qualifiers, from a UEFA perspective, even the qualifiers, because UEFA qualifying is 90% boring because it's usually teams that are way too good. You know, it's mismatches all over the place. The way they divided the Nations League up, there's about six good UEFA sides, really good teams. They're all like on each other's level, sort of thing. And then the rest, there's a huge drop off before the rest. Now that's not to criticise them. That's the reality of football. But the talent gap is so big that those games, even, you know, they just become routine and kind of dull. Even qualifiers, UEFA qualifying is by far the worst of all the confederation qualifying for the World Cup. You know, you compare it to South America's, which is just every game apart from against Bolivia because at home. It's just every game is just frenetic because every game matters, you know.
Mm.
And I love the Nations League. I think anything that makes international breaks more fun, you know. And yeah, like Jake says, you absolutely could see it. The players cared more, the managers cared more, even the fans cared more. Like it wasn't the sort of same apathy because it's competitive and it's against good teams.
The Wales Denmark one was a UEFA, that was a Nations League game, wasn't it? The anthems before that were, I couldn't tell because I thought I had it on the side. I couldn't tell who was home team at first because I hadn't followed it. Wales did their anthem, it was so loud. Then Denmark did it and it was so loud. So there was a clear, especially from those supporters, as I said, Wales in this new era of gigs with these young players, they were looking forward to test themselves and it was a competitive game against a good team. And they were well up for it. So I think stuff like that is great. And then also you see things like Rudiger slicing Pavard's neck with his studs. Although that wasn't intentional, I don't think necessarily. But it seemed as soon as it was competitive, that's obviously coincidence, but stuff like that never happened in friendlies before. And now we've got these like really nasty challenges going in. There's a bit of an aggressiveness.
There was definitely an edge to France Germany. You could tell. You're often sort of wondering what is the point of Deschamps' defensive football and friendlies and that. But you could tell in that game they were not about to lose their first game as world champions, because there were a few times where they could just slack off, but they were not happy. And then Germany equally were like, we aren't losing another bloody game. Yeah, they really. Yeah, it was. If it was a friendly, it would have been dull.
Yeah, they could have just parted off as.
Yeah, there would have been changes at half time. Would have been half the team would have changed. It would have been so.
France were just saving themselves for their homecoming walkouts as well after they won the World Cup. That was beat Netherlands 2-1. Ryan Babel scoring, which was a blast from the past with his red hair, Besiktas hair. But then afterwards, the party at France, the whole stadium singing about N'Golo Kanté and. Every France player just walking out one by one, dancing up to the World Cup trophy. They obviously had priorities there. But even then, the game was before that. It was a party atmosphere.
The game was very good.
But it was, it wasn't just complete mictake of a football match. It was party atmosphere, but then it was like, we can win here and we are world champions again, sort of thing. So they wanted to win, and that usually wouldn't have happened. They would have just been waiting for the party afterwards.
Yeah.
But the game was good, and then the celebrations
I think the second half of that game is the biggest illustration of why the Nations League is great. Because France go up, okay, fine, whatever. If that is not a Nations League game, 1-0, maybe it ends 2-0, maybe it's boring. But because it was a competitive game, the Dutch came back. They fought hard. They stuck to their guns. They came out. They waited. As soon as Deschamps brought on Mendy, boom, they attacked him. And it was tactical. It's the kind of stuff you don't do in friendlies because you can't be bothered. What's the point? It's a friendly. Mm. As soon as Mendy came on, which I'm sure was partly because of minutes, partly sort of let's try and get a second goal sort of thing from Deschamps, they went right for him, the Dutch. Instantly, like within 2 minutes of coming on, they'd attacked him twice, created two chances, one of them went in. You know, it was like, oh, okay, it's that kind of game. And then suddenly France is like, oh, hang on a minute, excuse me. And they come out and they start playing. And then Dembele is warming up on the sideline. This is the best example of how much this game matters. Dembele is warming up on the sideline. He's going to come on. Giroud hasn't played well. It's been terrible. Mendy sends in a beautiful cross. Giroud, stunning volley. Gives him the lead. Immediately, Deschamps sits Dembele down and gets Nzonzi up, and Nzonzi brings Nzonzi on to defence midfielder for Griezmann. Like, that, in a friendly, that doesn't happen. He brings Dembele anyway, because who the hell cares? That was, I mean, and I didn't like it at the time, because I was like, oh, come on, keep attacking, but that's Deschamps, isn't it? When it matters, he wants to win games, and it mattered, you know, and I think that, you would not have gotten anything like the fun we had in the second half last night in Paris that with a friendly, it wouldn't have been the same.
I think it's going to be interesting for the smaller teams as well, because now they're sort of paired with teams who are also on their level. It actually gives them a chance to turn up and play.
Exactly. To win
so
things.
They don't have to turn up and just get 11 men behind the ball for the whole game.
Yeah.
They're actually playing competitive games against teams that are similar level to
them. It's a very smart system. And honestly, I don't think it will be too long before UEFA are like, well, should we just do qualifying like this as well? Like, stratify it. I get the idea behind qualifying.
That's the point. If you put all the best teams together, then the actual tournament's going to be rubbish.
So you can't really do that. Yeah.
But I think we should finish, or at least touch on the fact that Giroud is now France's outright fourth all-time top scorer.
Ahead of Zidane
now. And he's only two away from Trezeguet.
Hell of a way to do it as well. Like, he terrible performance, not playing well, in his home stadium, 1-1, and just, like, I can't think of... The only way it could have been more Giroud is if he'd done the sweeping finish.
If it was a scorpion kick.
if he'd done the sweeping finish, you know, where he was on the ground, he did the sweeping thing with his left foot, and then pointed to the camera as he did his knee slide. That was just, I mean... I was going, take him off, he's rubbish. And he did that, and I was like, yeah, fair play, mate. Absolutely. And meant for the assist to come from Mendy as well. And I thought, tactically, just to touch on this once briefly, it really showed the options France have. Because when France are playing a normal style of play, Mendy doesn't fit because they defend. Mendy and Giroud both don't fit when France are playing a normal style of play because they sit deep, they counter-attack. That's where you want someone like Lucas Hernandez left back. You want, really, Dembele up front. when France had to push up and score a goal, Mendy, with his crossing ability, becomes a game changer at left back. And then Giroud, obviously, is a phenomenal target man, great link man. So in terms of France, just I know we didn't touch on them really, but if Deschamps can figure out how to use his players more situationally, because obviously not everyone is Mbappe and a player for all moments and all seasons.
Mm.
If he can figure out how to use his players situationally, France will get even better, you know, and which is absurd because they won the World Cup, but they could get even better.
So just to finish off, FIFA Pro have announced their World 11 nominations today. Kicking off with goalkeepers, they've got Buffon, Courtois, De Gea, Navas and Ter Stegen. And just to press you both on who you pick.
You know what? The one I would pick isn't even there. Jan Oblak. I think he's probably the most deserving. It's interesting, isn't it? Because you look at Ter Stegen won La Liga. You know, I'm going to go with Courtois. Golden Gloves World Cup. Can't argue with that.
I think Navas will get it. Champions League based.
Yeah, that's
but
true.
Again, I maybe wouldn't pick him myself.
Okay, next up, defenders. So we've got Alba, Alves, Carvajal, Chiellini, Van Dijk, Godin, Hummels, Kimmich, Lovren, Marcello, Mina, Pavard, Piqué, Ramos, Silva, Trippier, Umtiti, Varane, Vercelleco, and Walker.
Cool, what a bunch.
What a list.
It's hard to pick. I think Diego Godin finally needs to get credit for being the best defender in the world in terms of pure defending. So I'd put him in. Marcelo will go left back because there didn't seem to be that many left backs there, to be honest. I think there's a real dearth of quality there.
Van Dijk, perhaps?
Yeah. Godin Van Dijk would be ridiculous to have, wouldn't it? But because what you have to think about it is the Champions League winners are going to get picked. But personally, if you think about impact,
I think Varane would have to be in there, actually.
Yeah, so Varane, Godin, I think, in terms of defensive, and then right back should be Kieran Trippier.
The very best.
Yeah.
I would say defence. I would say Godin and Varane again. Although it'll be Varane and Ramos, because it always is. but it should be Godin and Varane, I would argue. Umtiti probably close third, but Varane won the Champions League, which is a bit better than La Liga in terms of the awards, so whatever. But either one of them, basically, alongside Godin. Right back. Yeah, Trippier.
It's not going to be Trippier, is it?
It won't be Trippier. It'll be Carvajal. But it could be Trippier. The thing with Carvajal is he's
what about Kyle Walker? Just became a record-breaking right back.
Actually, no. You know what? Yeah, Kyle Walker, Rafael Varane, Diego Godin, Jordi Alba.
Was Alba in there?
Yeah. I was in there, yeah.
I think Marcelo over Jordi Alba.
You can't go wrong with either of them, to be honest. They're both very good.
Yeah.
Interestingly, no shouts for Dejan Lovren there.
the world's best defender. How could we forget?
So, midfielders, we have got Busquets, yeah. Casemiro, Coutinho, De Bruyne, Hazard, Iniesta, Isco, Kante, Cruz, Matic, Modric, Pogba, Rakitic, Silva and Vidal.
I mean, it's pretty easy though, isn't it, for me? Busquets, Modric, and I forgot who that was going
to
be.
It's pretty easy. I don't know. Kante has to be in there.
Yeah,
I think he's proven that he is one of the best. Just consistently got better.
Isco was there, right? Isco was.
Yeah, I don't know if Isco would get in.
Modric.
I think for me, Modric and Busquets definitely, and I think probably Kante is third.
If Hazard is included as a midfielder there? So if they do it, if they do it as actual midfield threes, based on this last year, I know Busquets is just incredibly, incredibly good. But in terms of who I think they might pick and who I would be okay with picking, I'd say Kante, Modric, and Hazard.
That would be really interesting.
That would be a nice midfield.
It would be, wouldn't it? To watch Hazard dribble.
So, and if they're going with the 4-3-3, I think that would be my sort of leaning towards what the people are going to vote for and what I would be okay with seeing. Yeah. Obviously, you can argue Busquets all day should just always be defence midfielder. But in terms of last season, Kante just keeps getting better.
Oh yeah, Busquets isn't winning any fan votes.
Modric, it's not fan, it's player, isn't it?
Is it players? Maybe, I don't know. No, so, I think Kante probably. Everyone loves Kante, man. Yeah. How do you not love him?
Player of the month for the man.
He's a wonderful, wonderful man. So I would go Busquets, Modric, and probably Kante. But probably it will be Busquets. If Hazard's in then, as a midfielder, then Hazard will get in. So it'll probably be him ahead of Busquets.
Interestingly, three midfielders.
Oh, De Bruyne.
De Bruyne, yeah.
Oh, wait, God, no. Yeah.
De Bruyne instead of Hazard, probably.
It should be De Bruyne ahead of Hazard. Yeah, will it be? I don't know. Let's see.
That's what I mean. You can't argue with De Bruyne's season. So, yeah, as a midfielder, if Hazard's being included as a midfielder, then De Bruyne will pip him.
I was going to say, three midfielders from last year's list didn't get enough votes to feature on this one, and they were Thiago, Ozil and Verratti.
Oh, they all had relatively bad seasons compared to what their standards are, so you can't really argue too much.
So the 15 attackers are Benzema, Cavani, Dybala, Griezmann, Kane, Lewandowski, Lukaku, Mandzukic, Mane, Mbappe, Messi, Neymar, Ronaldo, Salah and Suarez.
It's basically who partners Messi and Ronaldo.
Yeah, right. I would go with Griezmann. I think
It's Harry Kane, though, isn't it?
I mean, Messi and Cristiano.
Golden
boot sure.
Yeah, golden. To be fair, in terms of pure goals, he was up there with the best. But Ronaldo gets there because he set about four new Champions League records. Messi had best La Liga season again, topped every attacking metric.
Didn't lose a game.
And the fact he's not in the top three for the best awards. Mm. Is weird.
Well, individual awards are very strange.
I know, but this is individual. But what I'm saying is player voted, everyone votes for Messi and Ronaldo. Like everyone, any player interview, they say these two are the top. So those two are in. And then, I think it's between Griezmann. It's got to be a World Cup winner because you can't win a World Cup in that year and not be the best. And who are the best World Cup winners in there? Mbappe and Griezmann.
Mm. Oh, God. Mbappe. Oh.
But Griezmann won.
Griezmann won the Europa League, but whenever you watch Griezmann play for France, he's very good, but he fits within the scheme of Deschamps' pragmatism because he's used to that from Diego Simeone. When you watch Mbappe, you're like, how does he even do this in this team? It shouldn't really be possible.
But I don't think that should count against Griezmann.
No, it shouldn't.
Griezmann, as we were saying, like tactically aware. Yeah. Like,
he's so clever.
Griezmann is underrated. I think every time I watch him now, I'm like, you're doing really, really, really clever things and. It's brilliant to watch.
Yeah.
Whereas Mbappe is just like, wow. Yeah. So if either of those got in, I wouldn't mind.
I think it will
be. I'd probably vote for Mbappe.
It'll be one of the two of them, I think. And I mean, it's just the thing with Mbappe that impresses me is just how often in the drudgery of the France team, he just illuminates it every time he gets the ball. It's really wonderful. You look at Rashford to see how easy it is for a negative manager to beat down an attacking player and rob them of their shine, but it doesn't work with Mbappe. He just keeps going.
And as well, obviously, this is. Mbappe's suspended, so he's not going to have three games to warm people to him. But I think the hype around him and the fact he's averaging goal or assist every 90 minutes in his career, he's going to be in there. Well, it'll be Griezmann, but I would vote for Mbappe.
So conclude, we're not sure.
Yeah, you can make some pretty good teams out of that, and maybe that's a bit of content we can do.
There's a lot of good players there.
But yeah, definitely, the midfield is tricky, and then Ronaldo and Messi are just. Automatic entries, I think.
Well, that's all we've got time for today, so thanks to our guest Jake.
No problem, thanks for having me on.
And Mo,
as always, it's been a pleasure.
And thanks you all for listening. We'll catch you again soon.